If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
In 2007, we made a wine together and we decided to call it Chester's Anvil, which fit in perfectly with our motto, get hammered on the anvil. Although we could have called it Chester's Plow and then it could have been get plowed on the plow, but it didn't have the same ring to it.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 461. This week we feature Greg Stock, winemaker at Landmark Vineyards in Sonoma. The history of winemaking in California may be brief in comparison to the old world, but the fact is, the quality stands on its own. Landmark Vineyards in Sonoma has its own unique history dating back to 1974, a special time in California wine. Greg Stock is the winemaker at Landmark, and he took the time to chat with me on the phone to get caught up on what's new in this part of Sonoma, as well as talk about the 2021 vintage. You can also hear Greg on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term wine terms. I'm here on the phone today with Greg Stock, and Greg is the winemaker at Landmark Vineyards in Sonoma. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing well today.
Good. Glad to hear it. Hopefully yesterday you were good, too. Sorry.
Yesterday was a good day, too.
Good. Have you guys finished up harvest? Are you still in the middle of it, or where you at?
You know, we finished up last Tuesday, and ironically, we're a Chardonnay Pinot house, and we finished up actually with Pinot Noir from Longitata Vineyard down in the Santa Rita Hills, which is very late for them. They're about a month late.
A month late? Wow. So as opposed to so many people being early, this seems kind of strange, doesn't it?
Harvest was unusual in that we did have an early aspect to it up here in Sonoma County, and then we had a lull, and then we were very busy later in the season, and ended busy rather than having it just trail off.
Sure, that's really different. But then again, when you're dealing with Mother Nature, she's the one who's dealing the cards.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. Well, what do you think? Do you have any opinions on what you've seen in terms of the fruit? I know you obviously can't get too strong of a thought on it, but what do you think?
The Pinots smell great, and that's always a good sign. Lot of red fruit. I think it's going to be a very good year. Rule of thumb is the first year of a drought is always really good. I'm hoping that is true this year. There's just not – our yields were down – not only grape yields, but off the press as well, because there just wasn't the juice available in the grapes, in the Chardonnay grapes especially. So, but I think it's going to be a very concentrated year.
Interesting. It's tough when you're working that way, obviously, because like anything else, you're in business to make a profit and you need to have the juice to be able to do it. Are you guys strictly estate, or do you lease, or how does that work for you?
You know, we actually purchase and always have purchased the majority of our fruit. Here at Landmark in Kenwood, we have about 11 acres planted. In the Russian River, we have about 100 acres planted of Pinot Noir. But all of our Chardonnay is purchased, and I've been here for 20 years, and a lot of the Chardonnay we get has been here since I've been here. So it's quite a long time.
Clearly, you've gotten to know it pretty well by this point.
I feel really lucky. A lot of winemakers skip around in their career, but I've been working with the same vineyards now for a number of years. I really think it takes probably 4 or 5 growing seasons to really get a feel for a vineyard.
That's an interesting concept, just thinking about it again, the fact that you're dealing with Mother Nature, that no matter how well you get to know it, you do get the occasional curveball, right?
Right. Like like this year, which in Sonoma County was an unprecedented drought. And, you know, I think the mid-70s was the last time that that was seen. And I honestly don't know anyone alive that was making wine in like 1975 to ask if there was anything that they did differently.
Yeah. Greg, let's talk about you. Again, this ability to be at a winery for so long. Let's talk a bit about your history. I'm sure you get asked this question a lot. Did you have that moment? Was there a, you know, was there a wine drinking family that you came from, or was it you just found wine one day? And how did this path become for you?
I did sort of. My parents, I would say, are wine enthusiasts, not wine experts. But growing up, I don't know if you remember going through tasting rooms in the 70s and 80s, but they used to serve, when you would go up to a wine bar, they'd serve you in these little wine glasses, and then you could keep the glasses.
Sure.
And my parents would bring those glasses home, so for Christmas dinner and Easter and any other holiday, Thanksgiving, the adults would have a big glass of wine and the kids would get a splash of wine while we were eating. And it really sort of made me appreciate wine early on. I really became a wine geek, I would say, when I was 19 or so, where, you know, it really wasn't cool at the time to be young and into wine. People thought I was a freak. But I did. I became very interested in wine early on and, you know, would shop, you know, be a really a, hit the retail stores even before I could legally drink and just really developed a love for wine. I went to college and had an interest in wine, but got a journalism degree. I worked in restaurants going through college, so I could never find a job that made more money than the restaurant business in journalism. So I really stuck with that and began putting wine programs together, and I worked retail for a while. And finally, I was like, in the restaurant business, I'm like, I never want my own restaurant, and I'm really here only for the wine. So I decided to go back to school and study enology.
Because your parents were tasting when you were younger and you were exposed to wine like that, were you exposed to a better grade of wine? Was it pretty much table wine, or was there an evolution in the family?
No, there was really, with them, there was, it was mainly, we lived in the South Bay, so it was a lot of Almaden, and, you know, the, I don't know if you remember the dancing animals on the labels.
Oh, yes.
And some of that stuff was pretty good. And, you know, we lived here in the North Bay, and my parents would go over to Napa, but I certainly can't remember any of the wines that we tried. They probably could not remember them either.
It's fun to think about that, though. Imagine all the wines you might have had that were, you know, pretty amazing and today would be considered spectacular.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and everybody starts somewhere. I mean, I started with Kanai and nobody remembers that. So there you go. Do you remember Kanai?
I don't remember Kanai.
Nobody
I don't.
Does.
You know, I remember Matus.
Oh, yeah. Right.
It was really Matus and Blue Nun.
Yes.
Were wines that my parents drank.
Yeah. Yeah. Those wines were they're etched into our brains. And now that we drink all kinds of stuff, you know, they're still there, which is really says something about marketing, I guess.
Right.
So let's talk about Landmark. A great deal of history here and also the connection to John Deere. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. We were founded in 1974 in Windsor by Damaris Deere Ford and a couple of her sisters and a few partners, but I really think of, well, and they made wine in Sonoma County for in the Russian River for a while, and it was really one of those sort of 70, 80s wineries that made Zinfandel and Gewurztraminer and Chenin Blanc and Merlot and Pinot Noir and Riesling, and never really focused on anything. And quite honestly, the wine was pretty bad. So much so that in, I think, like 1988, I think it was 87, 88, the Wine Spectator gave their Chardonnay a 64.
Ouch.
Ouch. So Damaris was like, well, there's a saying in the wine business that if you can't sell it, at least you can drink it. And I can't even drink this stuff. So instead of throwing in the towel, she decided to buy out all of her partners, sell the winery in Windsor, and build our current location in Kenwood, and at that time totally change the winemaking protocols. So it was sort of this revolution at that time where barrel-fermented Chardonnay was very popular. Helen Turley was one of the early consultants here.
Sure.
So native yeast and really a focus in the vineyard. And I was going to say Damaris talked her son and daughter-in-law, Mike and Mary Colquhoun, out to come out and run the winery. She was like, I'm 64. What am I doing? So they really ran the winery for years and years. And really focusing on Chardonnay and making a little bit of Pinot Noir. So Damaris is still alive. She lives in Jupiter, Florida. I think she's 93.
Wow. Good for her. That's what wine will do to you.
Yeah. That's what wine will do to you.
So there's hope for all of us.
Right.
Well, that's great. Being able to keep it in the family like that, I think it's a big deal.
Right. And then in 2011, Mike and Mary decided to retire, and they sold the winery to Fiji Water and Stuart Resnick. So now we are owned by Fiji Water along with Justin and Lewis Winery.
Okay, cool. And you also own Hopkiln now, is that correct?
And we bought Hopkiln in 2016, really as a permanent source for high-quality Pinot Noir. Have you been out there? It's a wonderful place.
Yeah, so Hopkiln, yes. In fact, we interviewed Denise Gill when she was in charge of hospitality out there. That was podcast number 11. We are now in podcast number 450 coming up next week and 13 years into this project. So,
wow.
It was a long time ago, but I loved visiting. In fact, I was there a couple of times. It's a wonderful winery to go to because it's so completely unique and a very comfortable place to visit.
It is, and we've done a lot of, it took like 3 months to put that building up, believe it or not. It was, it's this old stone, literally a stone hop kiln, and it took 3 months to put that building up in 1905. It made it through the San Francisco earthquake that devastated the North Coast as well as San Francisco.
That's amazing.
And we've really, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've done a lot of seismic retrofitting of the building there. And it's just a beautiful building.
It really is.
I don't know if you know, a Lassie movie was filmed there.
You know, I think I remember something about that. Didn't they have something in the winery about it? When was that?
It had to have been in the mid-60s. I think it was a winery even then. And I don't, Burgess Meredith is in it, is what I remember.
Oh, funny.
It's really a beautiful building, and it just happens to be located on one of the best places in the world to grow Pinot Noir.
It is definitely a place I would recommend people visit just for the uniqueness of it, especially when you come around the corner and you see it like, well, that's unusual.
Yeah, and it's in great shape. We're open, I think, Thursday through Monday out there.
Nice. Well, as a winemaker, do you have a mentor? Do you have someone that you look up to that is really the one person that really taught you or was the one who influenced you the most in the business?
You know, I think there are a few people. Eric Stern, my predecessor, certainly is a mentor to me. And I think what he taught me was to be patient. As a young winemaker, you're always trying to fix things if there's a problem. And a lot of times you'll just make another problem. Mm. And he was very much a hands-off winemaker and really let things develop and see where they went before he would do anything. And I also think we had David Ramey consult in the early aughts.
Yeah, David's a great guy.
2006. And David's just a great winemaker and very meticulous and thoughtful and really taught me. He was very much, you need to put in the work. You know, you need to put in the analytical work as well as the work in the cellar to really understand the wines.
And he's a darn nice guy.
And he's a super nice guy.
Yeah.
And his wines aren't shabby either.
No. We've interviewed him a couple of times, and he follows the podcast, which is a great honor. He's just a real nice guy. So what's the most unusual advice in terms of wine that you've ever been given?
Good or bad?
Yeah, I think that can go either way.
No, I really think that the best advice was Eric about, well, there are a few things. Eric told me that early on that basically the thing that he learned from Helen Turley was to buy better fruit,
mm-hmm.
find better fruit, always. And that's really probably the best advice that I think a winemaker can get where the winemaking certainly is part of it, but really where the grapes come from and how they farmed overwhelm everything else, where if you don't get good grapes, you're never going to have good wine.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And great grapes and great wine. And I think that's really the advice that I've gotten. So spend a lot of time looking at the vineyards and focusing in the vineyards.
So when it comes to something like that, I mean, is that a word-of-mouth advice? Somebody says to you, hey, so-and-so has grapes available, or I've tried these grapes, or is it simply from tasting, your own experience in tasting?
You know, it's a combination of both. So I think Rahill Vineyard, that we make a single vineyard designate from, really, the reason why we're working with that vineyard was try to wine from the 2007 vintage from Bill Hunter Chasseur Winery.
Mm, sure.
And it was one of the best Pinot Noirs that I've ever tried.
Hmm.
I essentially found out who the grower was, William Rahill, and cold called him and talked to him about the fruit. He said he didn't have fruit available that year, but keep in touch. And finally in 2012, we were able to purchase some fruit from him, and the wine's wonderful, and we've been making wine from there ever since. It's really both. Right now I'm spending time driving around the Russian River going, I wonder who owns this vineyard.
Mm.
This looks pretty good.
That's cool. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but obviously you have to search your grapes from somewhere. And is price a huge part of that? Is it what you might be able to negotiate? How do you go about that?
It's price and quality. I mean, of course, you know, we want our growers to make a living.
Sure. Yeah.
It benefits everyone. It's price and quality. And really the quality of the grower, because they can have a great vineyard, but if they can't pick the grapes on time, it's, you know, sort of all for naught.
from what I understand, part of your process is the idea of less is more as a winemaker, which I certainly respect. So just hearing you talk about this, it really is, it's all about the vineyard for you.
It really is. I mean, the winemaking is very, I don't want to say natural, because natural has a bad connotation, sort of.
Yes.
But the winemaking is very simple, where the Chardonnay is very traditionally made. It's all whole cluster pressed, all native yeast, all barrel fermented, all malolactic. And we, the reserve wines, Chardonnays, we don't filter.
Mm. Nice.
And then the reds are, you know, very naturally made as well, even though we do inoculate yeast. But it's very, very much a hands-off process. I figure if I do my job right, the wine that goes into the barrel or the juice that goes into the barrel will live its entire life in that barrel and only be racked to be bottled.
Nice. People often talk about Chardonnay and ageability, and I understand that's something that you're very focused on. I'm assuming, obviously, that's going to vary from harvest to harvest. But do you have a general approach to that in terms of ageability?
You know, I think, first of all, everything has to be there for the wine to age very well. But we've been working with Lorenzo Vineyard in the Russian River, oh, geez, since, believe it or not, 1996. Those wines, there's a misconception about Chardonnay that it doesn't age, and our Chardonnays certainly can develop in the bottle, and that really was a David Ramey thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the 2006 Lorenzo Vineyard is wonderful, and I think if the pH is correct, the wine will age for quite a while. And develop really secondary aromas and flavors.
I'm curious, do you get to spend a lot of time walking the vineyards? Is that something you do still?
Yes, I try to. Like I certainly don't sample every vineyard every sampling round, but I do sample the vineyards, and especially when we're getting closer to pick, I'll be out sampling in the vineyards. And looking, because I think picking is more than the analytical numbers. I can't say aren't important, they're important, but going out and seeing how the vines are reacting, and, you know, it's kind of common sense. If the leaves are falling off, you probably need to pick that vineyard.
Yeah.
No matter what the numbers are telling you. So I try and be out in the vineyard as much as possible.
See, for me as a wine lover, the idea of spending time in the vineyard just seems like a very zen kind of thing. You know, you really do have that connection, don't you?
Yes. But you're also looking for problems.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately, I mean, it's you're always looking for issues in the vineyard as much as, walking down the rows and enjoying being outdoors.
Yeah. I mean, there's a job to be done other than enjoying that.
Right.
So here's kind of a left field question for you. You can think about it if you like for a moment, but what's the weirdest thing you've seen as a winemaker?
Oh, geez. The weirdest thing I've heard is people, well, pre-smoke, and I don't know if it's affecting the smoke, but people were washing their grapes with ozone, which I thought was a very unusual thing at the time.
Are people still doing that?
A few people do. They're trying to make non-SO2 wines.
Mm-hmm.
So any bugs they're trying to get rid of, while we're kind of trying to encourage the native flora on the grapes.
Sure. That would be the best part, in my opinion.
Yeah.
This is one that can also go positive or negative, depending on how you want to take it, and that would be what makes you crazy about wine.
Wine is one of those things where I've had hobbies over the years, but they always fade. But my wine is just infinite in its how interesting it is. You know, I still go through phases. Like, we make Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. I'm actually drinking a lot of Zinfandel right now. And I probably went on a 10, 15-year hiatus from even thinking about trying a Zinfandel because they were sort of over the top and hot.
Yes.
But I've come back to that. I'm very much a Francophile, but I have an interest in Italy, too, that is really undeveloped. I always think I'm a wine geek first and then a winemaker, and I do. I just sort of still have a huge interest in wine, and not only our varietals, but just wine in general.
That's great. I like that you're a geek first. And Italy alone can be a bit of a rabbit hole to go down.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at least in France, you kind of, at least in my brain, there are things that I can hang my hat on, you know, or hang things on. But Italy is sort of this wide open place.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very good answer. So this has become my favorite question, and listeners hear me do that setup, and they probably run and hide. But for all the time you've been in the wine industry, I'm sure you've done plenty of media and interviews. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, geez.
I don't make them easy, Greg. Sorry.
Let me think about that because, you know, there's, I would say the question that people don't ask is, what do you do on vacation?
And what do you do on vacation?
It depends. Sometimes I have wine vacations like every other wine person, I think, on the planet. But then I'll go and I'll do something totally unrelated to wine, you know, go to Maui, go and do just something totally different and not even think about wine for a while.
Well, that seems like a healthy thing. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's your life, it's your occupation, but it's certainly not just something you do. It's, you're a geek.
Right. Right. So, you know, I'm probably going to go back to Burgundy this year.
Nice.
My goal.
That would be a good place to go, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Greg, obviously, we've all managed to so far get to this point in COVID, and I know a number of tasting rooms have changed with some of their rules and regulations, but you guys do have your tasting rooms, and they are open, correct?
Our tasting rooms are open. I think Sonoma County is... They still have a mask mandate for inside, but I think that's going away, and they're going to go back to a tier system here. But we're open here in Kenwood. We're open Monday through Friday, 10 to 4:30, and then Hopkillen is open Thursday through Monday, 10 to 4:30 as well.
Great.
And we've been busy.
Really? Well, that's not surprising, right?
Well, I think everybody's been locked up for so long, they want to get out.
Yeah, I get that. And for me, obviously, I've already talked about Hopkillen. I have been to your winery a couple of times, and it's a wonderful place to go to and very easy to get to. For our listeners to learn more about you, what is your website?
It's www.landmarkwine.com.
Very good. Greg, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. I wish you guys continued luck, and hopefully we'll all be back to normal and drinking even more wine soon.
Great.
Learn more by visiting landmarkwine.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2021.